Okay, so that's the title, and some of my collaborators, graduate students, and Terry Dubois that worked. We worked on compressible flows and support by NSF and Lawrence Livermore Lab. I assume that not everybody here is familiar with laughter simulation, so I will make rather long introduction, so even if you don't care about the last part of the talk, you will maybe have some, there will be some benefit from this. So we are dealing with the incompressible Navier-Stokes equations here. I don't know, actually, maybe on this end. And it is generally agreed that you know, if we can solve Navier-Stokes equations numerically, then they are as good as experiments in many instances. However, there is one serious limitation that if Reynolds number increases, then velocity variations occur on smaller and smaller spatial and time scales. So we really cannot, in practical terms, solve Navier-Stokes equations for all cases that we would like to. So one of the ways, there are several ways of trying to overcome this difficulty, is to introduce filtering, which is defined as some linear integral operation. In the simplest case, if we use stop-hat filter, it's just integration of the original function over some interval with delta. And with filtering, which here we have example of a signal which is filtered. So the red one is filtered one, and the solid line is unfiltered quantity. And as you see, we pretty much reduce variability in this filtered signal. So now, in numerical terms, to discretize this solid line, I would need simply more points than in case when I discretize the filtered quantity. So that would introduce savings in a computational sense. And at the same time, as you see, the large-scale fluctuations are pretty well captured by this type of spatial filtering. So this is the basis of large dissimulation methodology, which was actually introduced by Leonard in 74. So that's the filtering. And now if we apply this filtering operation to Navier-Stokes equations, then what we get are LES equations, which look exactly like Navier-Stokes equations for filtered quantity. Plus, there is additional term, which involves a gradient of Sapkowski stress tensor, which to calculate, we need to know product of these two velocities and filtered product. And this is usually information that we don't have because we know only the filtered quantities. So the problem in larger dissimulations is how to derive expressions for this Sapkowski stress tensor, because in practice, in large Reynolds number flows, this term is actually much larger than, for instance, viscous term. So it's dominant for high Reynolds number flows. And there are several modeling approaches which are used for this problem. The most popular is eddy viscosity model. In fact, in this field, I frequently repeat the same joke that the classical models are those that are used by someone else than the author. So these are two classical models, and the rest are, I would say, new models, usually used only by the author and his collaborators. So eddy viscosity model, even though not the best, I will criticize it a little bit, is one of the classical models in the sense that it's widely used in larger dissimulations. The idea is to use analogy with how viscous effects originate in molecular flows, and just relate a subgrid scale stress tensor to a rate of strain of results case, as in a Newton approximation, and the coefficient of proportionality is eddy viscosity, which on the basis of just simple dimensional arguments can be estimated using velocity scale, which is obtained from a rate of strain of results case, and there is length scale delta, which normally is associated with a mesh size. So numerics is already, in a sense, put into this model because the mesh size, which is used for discretization of the equations, is present. And the constant C sub S, Magorinsky constant, can be also estimated and usually is estimated on the basis of the inertial range spectrum. However, in many situations, it has to be adjusted depending on the type of the flow. What possible problems are encountered by this type of modeling? So that would be assumption for subgrid scale stress sensor. That would be assumption for, say, heat flux if we are dealing with compressible flows or with convective flows. Proportionality of subgrid fluxes to gradients of resolved quantities. Now, if we have direct numerical simulations which are well resolved, we can introduce artificial separation of scales between large and small, and we actually can calculate from DNS what these quantities are, albeit for small Reynolds numbers. But it can be done, and then we can try to correlate actual stresses, which are calculated exactly, with assumed proportionality to rate of strain or to gradient of temperature. And if you calculate these correlations, then normally they are very low. This is for particular flow. They would be around, 10-20%. So, in fact, this type of a priori comparisons indicate that the assumptions that we make here are not very good. There is very little correlation.
When you say correlation, you mean over time?
This is correlation over space. So this is, at each point in space, mm-hmm. I correlate tau and S, mm-hmm. and then this is averaged over, actually this is 2 pi for a computational domain. However, why these models, you would ask, if the correlations are so bad and everybody knows about it, why they are used? Because they have very important property that other models which have better correlations are lacking. Namely, if you look at subgrid scale dissipation, which is basically rate of energy transfer from large resolved scales to unresolved scales, which expression for that is just a product of tau and resolved rate of strain. Because tau is assumed to be proportional to rate of strain, we are getting that subgrid scale dissipation is always positive definite. So these eddy viscosity models always do what on average turbulence should be doing, namely extracting energy from large scales and passing it to small scales. So in global sense, these models are actually simulating this process of energy transfer from large to small scales reasonably well, especially if we adjust these constants that are present in the models. And there are several other versions of these models, Creighton's spectral eddy viscosity model, structure function model, dynamic model, which calculates this constant, treats it as variable, and calculates it from the resolved field. However, frequently, this lack of correlation actually is a problem, perceived problem in this field. So people were trying to resolve it by producing models that would have better correlations. And one of such approaches is similarity modeling, which I have here on different transparency. Well, this is the formula, which is very simple for subgrid scale stress tensor, and it could be easily calculated if we actually know the velocity field. We don't know it, but maybe we can approximate this velocity field. So the simplest approximation that you can make is to assume that unknown full velocity field is just equal to what you know, resolved field, and you plug it into the formula, and now you have closed formula for subgrid scale stress tensor in terms of the resolved quantities.
What are your bar symbols?
The bar symbol is filtered quantity. So the bar is what we know. Filtered quantity, that would be this one we know, and you we don't.
If you twice filter it, it'll be the same.
No, it's not, because it's special filtering. This is not ensemble filtering, so it doesn't have Reynolds filtering properties. So if you have time filtering or special filtering with finite widths, then subsequent filterings do not produce the same result. So this is not ensemble filtering. If you now perform the same a priori analysis comparing subgrid scale stress tensor, which is modeled this way, with the actual one, what will happen is that the correlations are very good, but this model, in fact, loses the nice property of eddy viscosity models, this dissipative property. Essentially, there is very little, almost nothing, in terms of dissipation. So this model pretty much moves energy of turbulence among resolved modes and doesn't pass anything to unresolved scales, and if it's put in actual simulations, the model simply fails. And there are different ways of improving on this by filtering with different filters and introducing additional constants, but usually the result is always the same. The model looks nice if you do a priori analysis, and it fails when it's applied in actual simulations.
Why is that happening?
The model fails. How does it fail?
If you, for instance, if you have energy, if you look at energy, let's take isotropic turbulence. You look at the decay of energy of isotropic turbulence, then the energy decay rate is initially okay and then slows down, and eventually there is no decay of energy. The energy is being conserved. And in fact, it should decay. The power spectra, well, it will tend to equipartition. So it would be completely wrong. And I will show some of such examples.
Sanjay, what if you view this U bar as sort of a first step in an iterative process? You do this as a first step. You feed it into your equations. You compute U bar, and then you make that ansatz again, and you
iterate. This is related, actually, to this so-called deconvolution procedures, and I will talk about this in just a moment. And Daryl, you still have a question?
No, it was the time.
Okay.
It essentially means that you put the fluctuations to zero at the smallest cutoff scale, right? Does it actually also that imply that you are ignoring the flux of energy?
Well, you think that you are not ignoring the flux, because it still has, at instantaneous time, some dissipative properties. The problem is that if you keep repeating this process in actual time-evolving simulations, this property vanishes. And the reason for that is that you do not involve in your energy transfer process any scales outside your resolved range. And this is pretty much equivalent to running Euler simulations on your resolved range of scales, and this will never be dissipative. So how do you, if you're an engineer, and I am, how do you solve this problem? Then, well, you say, well, I will add both models together, and so I will call it mixed model, and it has some dissipation, it has some correlations, And, you know, many people actually are quite happy with this approach. Obviously, this is not an approach which is based on the understanding of what's going on physically. You are just trying to mimic some turbulent processes like dissipation. Another class of models, which I think began evolving in recent years, is somehow related to similarity model, except that the idea here is that we want to approximate the full velocity UI by something which is here denoted by U tilde to design approximation which is better than simply taking resolved field that we already know. So that's, as you mentioned, some iteration process or something similar. So the approximate velocity models belong to this class when, in fact, we are trying to develop better approximations for the full velocity. How this could be done? One example which became recently popular are so-called deconvolution models or inverse filtering models. So formally, filtered quantity is result of this linear operator acting on unresolved field F. Yes. Now, so deconvolution is just inversion of the filtering operation if it can be performed either in exact or an approximate fashion. So if you look at this expression, then you can say, well, I can recover a complete field F by just taking inverse of applying inverse operator to a known quantity F. Remember, everything with a overbar is known resolved quantity. Everything without overbar is unknown. So formally, that's what I could do. If you use Fourier transforms, then obviously in terms of convolution, I will get product in spectral space, and then I get I can divide by the Fourier transform of this kernel G and take inverse Fourier transform, and that's how I would recover this quantity. If I have top hat filter, then the Fourier transform of top hat filter has this form of sine divided by a weight number, and obviously I cannot invert it in places where a denominator will be zero, yes, where sine k delta hat is zero. So not always this operation can be performed, but if I work with discretized forms, then I can always choose such sequence of wave numbers k, discrete wave numbers k, that k delta will never be zero. So discretely it can be inverted.
But I feel that I consider that as well here. Only a different zeros of sine is barely here.
Yes. Yes. Uh-huh. Now I'm talking about doing inversion. So formally, but this is type of the problem that people have been dealing with for a very long time in signal processing, because image processing in particular, because all images that are obtained are actually some transforms of the, let's say, the optics act as a transfer function which produces an image, and then you would like to recover the actual image from the picture. So there are well-known either exact deconvolutions for positive definite filters, so approximate deconvolutions for general filters, and there are a number of different approaches for that. Now, is this method better? Well, it seems, it looks on the first sight that it's better, but it's not, actually in my opinion, is not much different from the original similarity model that I discussed in the beginning, and this is the explanation of what is happening. Here, in fact, the numerical problems are also of importance. So let's assume that we have a field with energy spectrum, and that would be a complete velocity field U. Now, what we do in larger simulations, first thing is to apply spatial filter, which generally will attenuate all amplitudes for large wave numbers. Now, at this point, what we do in LES, we say, well, this signal has very, very little information in the range of high wave numbers, so high frequencies. Therefore, I can discretize it on finite mesh, let's say with mesh size delta. But at the moment when I discretize my signal, I introduce something which is basically equivalent to spectral cutoff, so that now, after discretization, I have only wave numbers up to this point, on this interval. I actually throw away this case. Why? Because they are small. Yes, but they are small only in this filtered signal. If I deconvolve complete signal, then this case may produce something actually sizable. But deconvolution procedures actually are applied to this interval, so if I deconvolve only the part of the signal up to this point, I will get only part of the actual spectrum. So what I denoted here is that if I use this type of approach, I have some approximation to subgrid scale stress tensor, which uses not the complete velocity field, but uses only part of the complete velocity field. And that's usually not equal to the actual subgrid scale stress tensor. And for that reason, this model behaves pretty much like similarity model if you don't have some artificial sources of dissipation, for instance, by numerics, then it would, again, will move energy only among resolved scales because there is no mechanism for extracting this energy from the resolved range. So after recognizing this fact, we realize that, in fact, there is no escape from trying to model in some fashion part of the spectrum which cannot be exactly recovered from the known scales. And that's the basis of the approach which we call subgrid scale estimation concept, which really is based on two observations. One, that the subgrid scale dynamics of the resolved scales, for instance in some range up to KC, are dominated only by finite range of unresolved scales. And I will illustrate this on the basis of simulations that were done some time ago, with Marc Brachet. These are simulations of a Taylor-Green vortex, and this is energy spectrum, K to minus 5 at Kerb, and dissipation spectrum is broken line. So now let's say that I introduce the maximum wave number in the simulations is 170, and I introduce, let's say, artificial cutoff at wave number 20. So I divide my scales into resolved ones and unresolved ones, let's say, and I can calculate all fluxes between resolved and unresolved range if I know all the amplitudes and phases. So this is so-called a priori analysis.
Do you believe the spectrum is down to 170 is actually fully resolved?
Yes.
In this simulation?
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So what happens here is now that I look at energy transfer which is normalized in terms of eddy viscosity. So think about this as energy transfer. What is solid line here, what is really important are the relative curves, not what they mean each separately. But solid line is representation of energy transfer from the range of scales from 0 to KC, that was 20 in our case, due to interactions of this scale with everything, which means from KC to this maximum wave number. Now, the next step is I introduce these artificial cutoffs, for instance, 3/2 KC and 2 KC. Let's look at 2 KC. So what I do now is I zero out all modes from 2 KC to 170, and I perform exactly the same procedure. I calculate energy transfer between this band and this neighboring band, which has wave number 2kc. And I calculate energy transfer, and I find that this energy transfer is essentially the same. So what it means, and if I have 3/2, it's also quite comparable. What it means is that the dynamics, energetics at least, of the most energetic modes is governed by nonlinear interactions only with neighboring bands of wave numbers and very little with everything else beyond that. So I seem to have some dominance of local energy transfers. So what it implies is that if I'm able to model only this range of wave numbers in terms of full velocity, then I may get reasonably good approximation for subgrid-scale stress tensor. So that's first observation.
That's in decaying homogeneous isotropic turbulence.
That's based on decaying, yes. But we did this also for channel flow simulations and for convective flows and for compressible flows. So this is an example of what you normally would observe.
In all those cases, the results were as good.
Yes. Okay. That the neighboring band of wave numbers is dominant in terms of the dynamics of the result scales. So this is first observation, and that was illustration of it. The second observation is that, which is actually trivial, because we know that initially the subgrid scales, if you start only with the result scales, will originate through process of nonlinear interactions from resolved scales. And we also think that they will strongly depend on them, the reason being that the large scales are more energetic. So what I mean by this here is the following picture from simulations which are initialized. You know, there is some cutoff, and we initialize the simulations with some spectrum, and we put zeros everywhere in the range of, let's say, this unresolved scale, and we now start running simulations, and as you see, there is build-up of small scales. Initially, there are zeros there, but, of course, the first band of wave numbers, which will become non-zero, comes from the fact that you have just nonlinear interactions about resolved modes, so you have just products of Fourier modes which will produce Fourier modes with wave numbers twice as large. And since these scales are also more energetic than those, then most of this, after this scale evolves, most of the effect of large scales on small ones is in fact advection of small scales by the large ones. So they certainly strongly depend on those scales, and this forms the basis of this subgrid scale estimation model, and I have a cartoon of what we are trying to do, and I will explain how we are doing this. So this is full velocity field. Yes. Now, filtering will reduce amplitudes in the range of large wave numbers, and sampling of this field on finite mesh is, or it could be either sampling or it could be spectral cutoff, will essentially reduce this complete description U to description through the field that I denoted U bar N, where N denotes that we have, let's say, N mesh points. And so that would be the field that we want to advance. To advance this field, I need subgrid scale stress tensor. It will be constructed by estimating this actual velocity field. And it's done, and this is done in two steps. One step is the one that I already explained. If I know part of the filtered field spectrum, I can recover through the filtering or this inverse filtering operation the part of the actual spectrum, which I denote by U0 tilde, up to my numerical cutoff. But beyond that, I need also I would in principle need the rest of those scales, but as I showed, the dynamics of what I'm interested in, namely up to this cutoff, is affected basically by only limited range of scales. So I'm trying to model only scales to about twice of my numerical cutoff. So I would need to introduce formally smaller mesh size to capture these scales. And how do I try to model it? Well, I will try to produce these subgrid scales from nonlinear interactions among known result scales, because that's the process which physically produces these scales. So that's the cartoon which will give me the velocity u0 and this nonlinear correction, and then I will use this in to calculate subgrid scale stress tensor. So that's the idea, and it was first implemented in spectral space, but if, of course, you are a practitioner in this field, then everybody will tell you that, you know, just forget it, it's not interesting, you have to do it in physical space, because that's how most actual codes work, in physical space and follow order methods. So this is how we approach this in the physical space, after seeing that it actually worked in spectral space. This is busy transparency, so if you you may remember just the previous one, that what we are trying to do, how it's done in practice, this is not really, you know, cast in stone, because it probably will evolve, and I had a number of discussions with Daryl Holm. So there are different ways of doing this, but this is one of the ways. So we assume that we have a signal which is LES field, the green one, which is discretized on mesh with the size delta LES, so that's the green mesh here. Yes. Now, I assume specifically that the filter which is used, filter width which is used in the filtering operation, delta, is twice the LES mesh size. Okay, and that will be important in a moment. This filter is actually independent of the mesh size. It could be equal to exactly mesh size, could be some multiple of mesh size, or just anything. But it's convenient to choose it as twice of the mesh size.
Clarify.
Yes.
Are you actually applying that filter?
Yes, it's actually applied at every right.
That's essentially
right.
Filtering all the
yes.
Small scale that you have.
Yes. Okay. So if now the first step of the procedure, I call it kinematic or this deconvolution or approximate inversion of the filtering operation, works as follows. As you know, I'm trying to find some field u0 such that this field, after filtering, will produce known field, UIN, this LES field. Now, this is known. Yes. Now, filtering, if it's applied, for instance, I'm here, if it's applied at this point, so I would like to get this value, will involve two neighboring points. If I use, for instance, a simple Simpson's rule or trapezoidal rule for filtering as integration procedure. So effectively, this formula is system of tridiagonal equations for the values of unknown function u0 with right-hand sides which are known values of LES field. So that first step actually will produce the field which satisfies this condition. So you can think about this as inverse filtering operation here. Now, I want to produce scales which are smaller than what I can resolve on LES mesh, so in fact I have to introduce smaller mesh with a mesh size delta LES2, because there is no way I can accommodate these higher wave numbers on the same mesh as delta LES. So I need smaller mesh size. And now I pretty much interpolate this red curve between known values to the smaller mesh size. And at, after interpolating, I generate subgrid scales in the following way. First, I calculate gross rate of subgrid scales by nonlinear interactions among result scales, and this is this big formula, but what it means, physical interpretation is rather simple. I have this field U0 and the gradient, so this is nonlinear term. However, I don't want effects which move small scales from one location to another by simply, you know, if you look at one point, then advection effects could bring small scales from another physical location to this point. So this is not generation of small scales, this is just advection process. So I remove advection process by taking just largest advection by the largest scales being removed here. Now, the process of nonlinear interactions has two effects, namely it affects all large scales and also small scales. It affects entire spectrum of scales. I don't want to include effects of nonlinear interactions on the largest scales, so I just remove filtered value of this term, which is approximation to the large scale. So what I'm left with is effectively the estimate of the gross rate of the smallest scales in this range between delta LES and delta LES half. But since this is gross rate, I also would need a time scale to produce my small scales, and this is usually something that would be on the order of larger the turnover time, and it could be implemented in different ways. What we did, we found it that it was most robust, was to assume that this energy of small scales that are produced by this procedure is proportional to the energy of the smallest result scales. So the smallest result scales, that would be this stuff here, is known, and assuming some spectral form transitioning from result to unresolved scales, you can estimate what would be the proportionality coefficient. And this way we get closed formula for this nonlinear correction. So this effectively produces my field, and as I mentioned already, it's based on heuristic argument, so it's not clear that it will always work and that's the best possible approximation. So what we need to do is actually to put this procedure in a numerical code and find out how it performs in actual simulations. So that's quickly testing. For instance, here I'm looking at channel flow simulations, and we have for comparison results of exact DNS. And we perform simulations with this model for lower and higher Reynolds number. And for comparison, we also run a low resolution DNS, which means the same resolution as in LES, but without any model. So we solve Navier-Stokes equations on a mesh that we know is just two cores. The quantities that are being computed, well, there will be stresses, nonlinear term which actually drives the equation, subgrid scale dissipation, mean RMS velocities, basically everything that people in this field calculate. Very briefly, how good is a guess for this unresolved field? If I start with DNS field, that would be the filter one. I'll recover first part and then model, unresolved scales. It actually, the modeling in some cases is very good. In others, it's not as good. But
these were all in depth recoveries with
Right.
These are all U squared quantities, right? These are all U squared quantities. These are RMS squared quantities?
These are spectra.
Yeah, I know. I mean, the label says U squared. Did you leave all
right. This is U squared. So this is in the middle of the channel. You have a plane, and it's averaged over spanwise direction, Fourier transforms in streamwise direction. And so
I'm talking about the labeling. Is it one half missing, or are we looking at U squared?
We are looking at U squared.
Okay.
So now, very quickly, if I look at some of these quantities, for instance, so this is bottom of the channel, this is top of the channel, and I average the tau 1 3 subgrid scale stress tensor over horizontal planes, and basically the comparison, what we have comparison with exact quantity calculated from DNS and the modeled quantity. And similarly here, we have subgrid scale dissipation where there is comparison of exact and modeled quantity. Red curves are the exact, red curves are the modeled, and solid are exact. The point is that, for instance, any similarity model would fail for this quantity. And once it fails, then it has, even slightly, actually.
Why is it not symmetric?
Because for this we had only four fields for averaging the in steady state, so we didn't have enough sample for averaging. If we used, let's say, 10 or 20 fields from these simulations, then you can get the symmetrical curves.
What do you mean by fields?
This, why there is asymmetry here, because this curve is produced by taking instantaneous results at four different instants of time in the simulations, and three of them actually are spaced very closely, and the instantaneous fields are not symmetric, only averaged over a long time.
The thing you're comparing to is not actually as good as it could be.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if this quantity wouldn't be predicted, well, then basically what will happen is that you fail in predicting, say, mean quantities. So that's the prediction compared with DNS results. That would be the curve that you get if you run just simulations without any model, and in particular... this is mean velocity. So this is normalized mean velocity. This is the wall, and this is velocity profile as we move away from the wall. So the velocity increases, and it has this classical form when there is actually logarithmic layer here. So this is comparison of modeled and exact, and this is what happens if you run simulations without any subgrid scale model, and in particular, if you go to higher Reynolds numbers, if you don't have a model, or you have a model which doesn't have enough dissipation, the prediction for mean flow is way off the actual experiments. Or here there are two types of simulations. One is dynamic model, and the other is our model. So it was, we have also results for RMS velocities for low and high Reynolds numbers, but I will tell you what goes wrong, yes, and why we have to do something better. If...
We basically had a jump, or it is a difference that we... Which, so the question is, how is that actually determined by our lambda? Does increasing a lambda increases the jump even further, or is it...
Which jump?
If you can show me...
Yes.
There's the... a jump in U plus, for example, as you go into the interior, and relative to the dot itself. And the question is that... difference.
You mean about this jump, about this here?
Yes.
Yes.
That's
no, this actually, if you increase Reynolds number, then the simulations get worse and worse. If you don't have a model.
Right.
Okay, so the difference will be increasing. And that actually is the plot I was trying to put here. This is for isotropic turbulence when we actually increased Reynolds number to very large values. So this is Kolmogorov spectrum, and what happens is that, you know, that would be what, if you don't have any model, that would be this curve. So it tries to go towards equipartition, and with our model we are actually not doing much better. And that's the reason for that, is that previously we had Reynolds number, even though relatively high by some standards, is not extremely high. So there is still effect of molecular viscosity which actually helps in those previous simulations. And now if we go to very high Reynolds numbers, essentially we are trying to simulate with Euler equations inertial range, the simulations fail. And the reason for that is that a model for subgrid case doesn't have enough coupling developed between resolved and subgrid case that would guarantee sufficiently high energy transfer. And you don't see it if Reynolds number is lower. It appears when Reynolds number is high.
In that plot where you showed how much energy was transferred between different scales, what you're saying is that if you go to higher Reynolds number, you need a bigger gap.
Yes, well, if I go to higher and higher Reynolds numbers, then my prediction deteriorates.
That's if you keep a constant Kc.
Yes.
Yeah, but if you kept increasing Kc, it would be...
Well, yes, but I want to keep constant Kc. So what it's the way to cure this problem, because we had to do something about it, obviously, yes, was to move to truncated Navier-Stokes dynamics. What I mean by this is, again, this is another busy plot, but the description is sort of here. So this is our field, and I start with this dotted line that would be initial field, yes, and again, I recover by the convolution part of the spectrum, and I produce the velocity U prime. And rather than calculating subgrid scale stress tensor, I let this entire field to evolve through Navier-Stokes equations, truncated in a sense that I don't have anything beyond this range. This, in fact, produces much better phase relationship between resolved and modeled scales, but in time, these small scales, because they have faster time scale, will deteriorate. So after some time, I simply have to stop the calculations and remove this case, recover my modeled field, and then move to next segment of truncated Navier-Stokes simulation. So I basically go in steps, and some people are already laughing, but hey, it works. Let me just show you what happens here. We looked at forced and decaying turbulence simulations at Reynolds number from about 100 to close to 10,000. So at this range, with this resolution, we effectively are in the range where effects of molecular viscosity are completely unimportant. We are really trying to simulate. We have Euler equations, plus we have this term, nonlinear term, which models energy transfer. And if I put everything on all these simulations on one curve, then we are getting, you know, that would be span of simulations for just one run. But now here I have 10 different simulations. And the comparison here is with Kolmogorov spectrum continued in the range, dissipative range, by the exponential form, which is well known for dissipation range of turbulence. So these simulations capture essentially both inertial range and dissipative range of turbulence. And in fact, in this range, summer here, the old model works just fine. It starts getting bad only when I move to very high Reynolds numbers. And moreover, there is prediction for Kolmogorov constant. Away from the forcing band, we are really in the right range, and there is nowhere input concerning Kolmogorov constant into this simulation. So that can be considered, you know, as reasonable simulation, which not only predicts the shape of the spectrum in both high and low Reynolds number range, but also Kolmogorov constant.
Just remind us, in all those cases there, the calculation is fixed resolution, and you're
yes.
just changing all the parameters.
Yes. And now I will show you also, there are some other curves here which I have enlarged on next transparency. What happens if you, you know, do it without the model? So, for instance, if you don't have any model, that would be result for the energy spectrum, and this is K-square, so this is equipartition spectrum. So in other words, if you don't have a model, then you just get equipartition as you should at these high Reynolds numbers. Yes. Now, if you don't model this band of subgrid scales, you can say, I can put there just zeros. I don't model it. I provide possibility for energy to flow from large scales into this basin of, you know, which is open. I put zeros there. This case will develop. It still will not work because I have not enough dissipation, and obviously I'm not even close to the inertial range.
Sorry,
so that's this range.
What's K eta?
Oh, this is eta is Kolmogorov length scale. So that's standard non-dimensionalization for this type of problems. So this is length scale. Eta K is wave number.
Okay.
Okay, you're implying that what you do is you run a certain time, you restart the problem, you run,
right.
you restart it.
Right.
So how would you pick the restart time?
That's a good question. It's about, it's, that was only by experimenting here. It's about, you know, anything between 1 to 5% of larger deterrent over time was giving the same result. So it's not very sensitive. In fact, these guesses are not for when to stop and what are my predicted subgrid scales. The evolution of the largest scale is not terribly sensitive to that. And but still, you know, you would like to avoid some of the problems with this restarting every number of time steps. And the procedure for that is actually, we found that was probably the most robust, is to run in parallel LES equations and truncated Navier-Stokes equations. In a sense that, you know, if I run through deconvolution and modeling of subgrid scales, now I run Navier-Stokes equations, I will produce the field which will have certain moments, you know, for instance, mean velocity at this point. Now, I reduce it, again, through filtering and sampling to new field, that's what I did before, and now I will produce initial condition for the next Navier-Stokes sequence. But the procedure, the way it is, you know, has to be designed should be such that all the moments of the field from the previous Navier-Stokes segment should be equal to moments of this field at the beginning of next Navier-Stokes segment. And there is no guarantee that this actually occurs. So you may introduce various discontinuities, and the best idea that we found to avoid these problems is just to have this truncated Navier-Stokes sequence, and at each time step calculate subgrid scale stress tensor and feed it into LES equations. And in LES equations, the quantity which is evolved will be continuous without any jumps. The only thing that possibly may have jumps will be small jumps in tau, but tau is only small small term in the actual LES equations, important but small. And this actually worked perfectly for...
There is one point I didn't
yes.
catch. What viscosity do you use in Navier's loops?
Viscosity is set. So I can set it to any value I wish. So now what is happening is Reynolds number increases, then viscosity formally goes to zero. So I can run these simulations with viscosity effectively zero.
So then it would be Euler and not that it would work?
That would be Euler simulations without viscosity, but with the model term, and that works. Yes, so the viscosity can be set to zero as it should in large Reynolds number flows. So if this method is applied, then it essentially works for, we repeated this for all flows that we had before. I think I should be finishing here. So this is just repeat for forced turbulence. We did also simulations for a standard decaying turbulence cases. For instance, this is a classical comparison with Comte-Belot and Korsin. So this is initial energy spectrum, and essentially the modeled and experimental data for the spectra are here on top of each other within the resolved range. So it works for this decaying isotropic turbulence simulations, and it works also, just repeated, for channel flow simulations and this new model is LESPZ. So it basically gives the same results as previously, the model which we know in principle doesn't have enough dissipation, as I mentioned. It just worked because the Reynolds numbers were low enough, but the model that is applied here, this curve, now works for all range of Reynolds numbers. I don't think I should continue with other results. Obviously, I have quite a lot of them. I will just mention very quickly that this model has been extended, and I think that's the main advantage of that, to number of other flows. For instance, for compressible flows, you have different type of averaging, fast averaging, and you need also to calculate tau, and you have additional quantities, average scale heat flux, but you apply exactly the same procedure. Essentially, anything that any nonlinear process, any transfer process which is governed by the nonlinear term, be it for temperature or velocity, is subject to exactly the same type of modeling. So there is no need to introduce additional assumptions if you introduce new physics into the problem. For this one, we did a number of, actually two different problems evolving turbulence. This is spatially evolving turbulence and also a shock turbulence interaction. I will just show you a prediction for shock. This is mean velocity in DNS and comparison with LES. The flow is from left to right, and there is a shock obviously at this location. What is prediction?
What's the Mach number?
Mach number is 2, around 2. What is probably more important than this shock location is to see what happens to the kinetic energy, this one. So the kinetic energy is obviously much enhanced at the location of the shock, but the model, which is a dotted line and the solid line is DNS, actually captures both the shock and decay of turbulence behind the shock, which is not actually a trivial task. And the model here,
are you capturing shock with due to molecular viscosity here?
Yes, the shock here is just shock, you know, just shock capturing method in this case.
Well, no, that's what I'm asking. Is shock with due to the actual molecular viscosity you put in, or is there some sort of artificial viscosity?
No. It's actual viscosity. Okay. Yes. Uh-huh.
No, what he's saying is there's turbulence in this problem, is there?
There is turbulence in this problem.
What he's saying is the turbulence makes the scale, not the viscosity. Is that true?
But shock?
The simulations, the way they are run is basically you have simulations where there is a shock and there is inflow.
Is this a 1D problem or?
Inflow, no, this is 3D problem, and there is inflow boundary conditions which are turbulent.
Okay.
So what we are plotting here is energy of turbulent fluctuations. And that's the location of the shock, and the turbulent fluctuations go up at the location of the shock.
Okay, you're actually asking a different but also interesting.
No, but I'm saying the width of the shock that you measure,
mm-hmm.
is that associated?
The shock is resolved in this case. There is very fine resolution at the shock. So in that sense, you know, it satisfies all the
shock
the
should be infinitely
it should
stable.
Be, yes, it's not.
Okay.
Of
so
course it's not.
It's thick, it's the turbulence model that's resolving.
Well,
the
no, it could be the molecular viscosity.
Well,
it's too large for that.
Not for, he may have a very...
No, this is shock capturing method, so the shock is actually smeared over several, you know, grid points.
That's what we're asking about.
That's numerical. Okay.
That's right. The width, now, is the width numerical or turbulent modeled?
It's numerical.
Okay.
But as small as possible.
Well, that's a matter of... It's not adaptive mesh, is it?
No, this is standing shock.
So you just set up a grid to catch?
Yes.
To put zones on.
Right, and it's just, you know, there is fine grid here and the distorted mesh away from that. Well, in any case, I don't have to talk even about the other one. The point here is that the subgrid scale energy is very significant. The model actually does a lot of work. So let me conclude very quickly that it's somewhat, you know, painful process. I described to you what, you know, steps we did. Some of them looked very promising originally. When you change range of parameters, then they are less promising. But eventually we developed procedure which seems to be applicable to all Reynolds numbers that we tried and to several different flows. And what's nice about this procedure is that everything actually is formulated essentially in terms of truncated Navier-Stokes dynamics. And in terms of implementation, you can think about this as running Navier-Stokes equations. If you have Navier-Stokes code, you run on coarse grid Navier-Stokes equations for some period of time. You stop the calculations and update the final condition and use it as initial condition for the next sequence. So the method consists of only Navier-Stokes solution plus post and pre-processing of the solution that comes from the code. And this has been validated on several different flows. The reason why it's interesting, I think, is that this procedure can be is applicable in exactly the same form to any physical quantity with dynamics dominated by the nonlinear interaction. So if I have stratified flows, if I have convective flows or compressible flows, all terms that normally in large-order simulations require modeling if equations are averaged are modeled within the same framework. In fact, in the simplest case, no modeling even is involved, only these sequences of truncated Navier-Stokes equations. So I think that, and we need, of course, to do more work.
So in how would you say what is happening? You know, you see that upturned spectrum, which is the signal that you're in trouble, and in some sense is what chooses your time interval. What's going on in physical space when you're doing this passing back and forth?
Are you getting jitters? Or lots of waves?
In other words, obviously there are going to be sort of like, say, 3D worms, sheets, and whatever it is. And or 2D, you can talk about something different. So what happens is the thing evolves to the precipice where, oh my God, I can't continue anymore.
No, it doesn't go that far. It's actually, you know, we looked at this mostly in spectral space. So essentially the spectrum starts, you know, rising. How much it can evolve over small percentage of large eddy turn over time? Not much. So you could make these cuts in your evolution more frequently. You don't want to do it too frequently because then you don't allow for build-up of nonlinear coupling between those anisotropies. But if you wait too long, then you will get the situation that you pushed it too far. So what is happening in physical space? Probably not much. Your structures will become distorted somewhat, but only will have some, you know, wiggles in the smallest case. That's where, you know, the procedure starts breaking down.
But normally, of course, it's interesting. I mean, if you look at a simulation of homogeneous turbulence, we see vortex tubes. So then the question, of course, is, and then we have already seen now simulations on different resolutions, starting from 30 cubed up to 1,000 cubed or 2,000. And one sees that these worms actually become smaller and smaller and smaller, and they bundle into clumps where lots of worms are, and then there are other regions that are much fewer worms. So that's this kind of idea is already around. And of course, one would in principle expect that as you take your model, you would in principle try to recover exactly the same kind of scenario.
No, because in fact, I'm trying to model only the largest scales, and these very small worms that we are talking about are seen essentially in very, you know, viscous simulations. So I don't know if they are properties of inertial range or if they are properties of the dissipation range of turbulence.
He's guessing
this. I'm guessing this, yes.
You're claiming that if you really did a high Reynolds number simulation, that structure would actually be forced to very small scales.
Yes, and I wouldn't be able to capture these very, very small scales in this type of simulation. Mm-hmm.
But you have done a homogeneous turbulence calculation, right?
So among others, yes.
Yes. Uh-huh. So which resolution did you use, and how does it look like in your space?
Well, it's done up to like 8,000
Reynolds. Right, but the resolution, actual resolution in terms of number of modes, was very small, 32 cube, because that was done LES with the model. Yes, I think we made estimate what it would be required to do the simulations, you know, down to the dissipative range. It's something, you know, on the orders of tens or hundreds, thousands cubed mesh points to cover entire range. Mm. So I'm in these simulations, you are trying to capture only the larger scales.
There's another question to ask, and that is, You set out the problem to be calculate the mean quantities of spectrum and say even the heat transfer. Okay, now supposing, let's go to the compressible problems, an example. Supposing I ask you that what's important to me is the shock width. Mm-hmm. That doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Then the question to ask me is what would happen if the shock wave hits some inhomogeneity?
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is a very important thing in astrophysics.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to work either.
What this model will do is only the following. As you see, what we did was to rework somehow the nonlinear term. And as long as you have continuum of scales from the resolved ones to some band of unresolved ones, then you could estimate them based on the nonlinear dynamics. If you have wide separation of scales, then obviously using nonlinear term will not help you in any way. For instance, if you have effects of combustion, that would be the most typical effect. Effects of combustion on the molecular level, they are not really directly produced by the large scales. They are not so I wouldn't be able to model effects of combustion in this framework.
The point is that once you have chocolates running around, you've got coupling between large scale flows and small scale flows.
Yes.
Immediately.
And you have to know. Yeah, it's not a cascade. So this is based on the concept of cascade and on the concept of interactions which are rather localized in spectral states. So it's not good for everything. I'm not trying to sell you snake oil.
No, I realize that. Yes. The idea is where, when you ask the question and you're interested in it, is it going to answer it? And
right.
If you're selling
right.
it to the engineering
yes.
community,
uh-huh.
and if I'm a little bit outside that community of yes. test models, or if I
yeah.
want to know, for example, the fifth moment, like the
kurtosis. No, for instance, if you want to know even, you know, lower or in moments like skewness,
yes.
which is affected by the dissipation range, this model will not tell you what the skewness is
right.
because it doesn't
exactly.
simulate
right.
dissipation range.
So any effect that is important to these higher order things that you're looking for,
mm-hmm.
for example, a PDF of something,
yeah.
you're not going to get.
Because you are getting here only large scales. So anything that you can get from the large scales, you know, what is dominated by large scales.
When you get a good approximation, you believe of a turbulent drag.
Yes.
Things like that.
Yeah, turbulent drag or, let's say, even mixing in, you know, turbulent environment.
You get the drag crisis out of this, right?
I didn't try. I don't know.
But by definition, drag crisis is a small scale effect. And the body is...
Well, the point here is that you see, even you may also say the following, that the dissipation is a small-scale effect because it occurs at the smallest scales. However, you can look at the dissipation from different point of view, that the large scales actually set up the flux of energy down the scale, and the small scales just adjust to whatever they get to dissipate that energy. So I can predict dissipation, which seems to be small-scale effect, from these considerations, because dissipation is directly coupled to what is happening in the large scale. So some small-scale effects like this could be obtained. So about drag, I don't know if it responds to what is happening in the large scale. Maybe I could get that prediction.
I think we're asking questions about the LAS approach in general rather
mm-hmm.
than your approach in particular.
Well, yeah, there are, I think, two ways of looking at this. One is that you know small-scale processes and you are trying to parameterize them on the large-scale level. Yes, that lot of oceanographic work or atmospheric work is in this spirit. The other approach is here, if I know large scales, you know, what is the maximum information I can get from this case without, you know, knowing details of small scales. So that's, I'm approaching that from this point of view, and this is good for some of the terms, like classical subgrid scale stress tensor or classical subgrid scale heat flux. So that would be applicable to convective flows, to stratified flows, to just incompressible flows, or to weakly compressible flows where the shock effects are not dominant.
I just want to make sure I understand this correctly. Is that the post-processing after 10 or 5% of the turnover time, does this really just consist in filtering?
And deconvolution.
Well, it's filtering, sampling, and then it's a little bit more than that. I
would have to see that, but maybe after the talk.
Maybe after the talk, because it's technical.
I
can explain.
Could you, you could concatenate this process? Like, do you go from kappa to 2 kappa, and then can you go to 4 kappa, and you think about
Well, you could formulate this as a multi-level scheme.
Yeah.
of course.
Like Richardson extrapolation.
Well, but that would be, you see, Richardson extrapolation is just purely mathematical, doesn't involve any dynamics. You
right.
are just,
but, I'm saying
but
concept,
here.
That's what he meant by concatenation. The idea of saying, I'll go from 1 to 2 and then
from
four,
this, yes,
and
eight, yes.
And then I will sort of.
Right.
To zip it up and...
I think it could be formulated this way. That's what, you know, this work by Temam and Dubois also is that, you know, having sequence of these cutoffs. But the difficulty here is of practical nature, that each factor of 2 is actually order of magnitude because it's 2 in power 3 in terms of resolution. So... It might be nice as a formulation which basically takes you from the results case to the full DNS limit because you can go through that, and but it wouldn't be practical as a tool.
Okay, I have a question which is sort of, I saw somebody demonstrate this kind of thing, and the idea is, you said that you would get the drag correctly, so let's do fall around the sphere, which is the canonical object. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I ask you, how close is the drag starting at 8 cubed? You go 8 cubed, 16 cubed, 32
mm-hmm.
cubed, and then you watch your approach to drag.
Mm-hmm.
Have you done that?
No.
Okay. Because there's a whole school of people that go under the name of miles. I even forgot what it means.
Yeah, monotone,
say,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, I'll just take my favorite algorithm, which doesn't
right.
blow up, by definition.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I'll compute with it, and
mm-hmm.
I'll show you this curve of the drag versus, you know, it doesn't blow up. I say that there's something
yes.
in there in the algorithm. And the question is, will you do better than that?
I hope so. But I haven't tried that, yes. Yeah, that's my question. Well, you see, with the mice approach, the difficulty, of course, is that all the dissipation is provided by the numerical scheme.
Right.
So you know, you cannot make any physical arguments. You know, it's if this is correct or if it's
yeah.
not.
I guess another way of phrasing that question is would be, as long as you have some dissipation there, does
yeah.
it really matter?
Well, for instance, if you use a piecewise parabolic method,
yeah.
you know, you solve Euler equations,
right.
yes?
Right.
And then what you get is inertial range spectrum and dissipative spectrum. But,
yeah.
of course, from physical point of view, if you think about this, it's nonsense, because if these are Euler equations, you cannot get anything except equipartition of energy. You should get k squared.
We all know that
yes?
only the Euler equations a priori. As soon as you're doing the calculation,
yes,
you introduce
yes. dissipation.
Right. But you can
now,
estimate
but there is no, there is difference because there is dissipation in actual world, the physical dissipation which is provided by the nonlinear interactions and viscosity, and there is dissipation introduced by numerics,
yeah.
yes? So you never have guarantee that your numerical scheme is equivalent in terms of dissipation
no, but
to...
The
that's my objection.
Yeah, no, I understand. I'm just saying the numerical scheme has higher order term. You can explicitly display them.
Mm-hmm.
They may not fit the Smagorinsky at the same order,
yes.
right?
Yes.
But then
mm-hmm.
again, there's something wrong with the Smagorinsky, so it
mm-hmm.
doesn't
yeah.
matter if they fit
right.
the Smagorinsky.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, do they fit essentially the kind of...
What I'm saying is the point. If you have... No, if you have... I think the right test is the following. If you have spectral code with no numerical dissipation, yes, that's how you should test your model in terms of, you know, how physical it is. Because then you actually, if you run Euler equations using spectrum, then you get k-square spectrum. So that's the physical result. Yes, so that's, you know, that's what we are trying to do. All we did, essentially, you know, high order spectral methods.
I think he's out engineering you. I mean, you started
yeah.
by saying, well, really, I'm an engineer and I want to get a result. But in fact, you're making very physical sort of arguments here.
I apologize.
I have to tell you just a little story. Many of you know him, but Kunio Kuwahara showed me some simulations.
Mm-hmm.
And he carries around a little PC all the time now. In the old days, he did. And he says, Norman, I'm going to show you the coefficient of drag around the sphere. Question I just asked him. He says, first I'm going to do with 8 cubed, then 16 cubed, and then he just plots the graph. And he shows you how fast he converges.
And
he doesn't use any, he just uses his favorite algorithm, whatever it is. And I'm not justifying his approach, but from the engineering point of view, his approach is justified.
No.
If it's reproducible.
Not only this. Not only this. Only if you know the result.
Function and delta wing and many other shapes. In other words, just because it works for one problem doesn't prove that it works for every problem.
And if you know the answer norm, then you can say when to stop.
Right.
But if I'm dealing with problem when you don't know the answer, then you want to have physical model.
The thing is, he has a physical model. You may not like it. His model is whatever his code puts in.
Right. So it's a physical model.
No,
that's
no, it's not physical model.
There's no physical.
It's a regularization. I'm sorry.
That's not
physical model.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
But he just showed. You don't understand its properties.
I understand. But he showed that a physical model, namely the first Smagorinsky model, is inadequate.
He showed that even more clearly, I think, over the last hour.
Yes.
So could you imagine actually dealing with the problem of the buildup of in the kappa to 2 kappa band by moderating the transport when you get to
I think we talked a little bit about this, because that's actually the alpha model that's been also, I guess, in development for several years. The idea there is that rather than predicting every number of every large interval of time what this case should be, you keep them this case always under control. So you run truncated Navier-Stokes equations effectively, but with scales in that second band damped by this alpha filter.
Just slowing down the transport.
Yes.
Yeah. So it won't go back to that equal condition.
So it is possible, but then there is still, similar question, how often I should interrupt my evolution, and in your case, why do you use this filter?
Yes. Also the issue of talking back from the 2 kappa band to the kappa band.
Well, KC, that's kappa, and 2KC.
There's one term we never mentioned in here, maybe implicitly, and that's the term backscatter.
All right, yeah, it's here all the time.
What I'm saying is that when you talk to geophysical fluid dynamicists, I'm not an expert in this, but I've heard you talk, that's a very important issue to them. It almost comes up like 10 minutes into a seminar, this turbulence modeling. If it's such an important issue to them, then if I took your procedure and applied it to their problem, what do you think I would get?
Well, we looked at backscatter specifically here, yes, and the backscatter, amount of backscatter that you get depends very strongly on the ratio of the filter width that we apply to the mesh size.
Right.
If filter width and the mesh size are about, one comparable, then this might be, on the order of, maybe 10-20% backscatter of the total transfer. If the filter width is much larger, and in our case it was twice mesh size, then it drops very significantly. So it's small. And it depends also not on whether filter is in physical space or whether it's spectral filter. If it's spectral filter, you get huge amount of backscatter. And I think that we looked at this originally, and it's...
You say it's going to be sharp spectral filter.
Yes, sharp spectral filter, and then you get a lot. So what is backscatter will depend very strongly on these factors, and in fact, in our case, we found that backscatter is very small, just because it's physical space filter, and the filter width is much larger than the mesh size, factor of two.
You have the adjustable parameters in this sense.
You see, the point is that I advance these filtered equations at different points, but the basic quantity that I'm trying to estimate is unfiltered quantity. So in that sense, you know, I'm trying to get rid of the filter by first this deconvolution procedure. So I'm trying to reproduce unfiltered fields, so it should be independent of the type of filter I use.
Let me just make a comment that you made, that the shock and the turbulence represent different scales, so they're interacting immediately, which is troublesome. Let's go to a stratified medium. Supposing I have density layers that are small. They act like, in some sense, the shock. So if I have turbulence over a large scale, I have lots of small little small scales. I'm not going to get the right answer.
Well, if I put enough resolution there, then I will. If you can make the same argument about boundary layer. See, for instance, to resolve boundary layers for mean and RMS velocities I had here to use DNS, I would need resolution order of magnitude higher in DNS than what I had here in LES. So what is happening in these cases, I still can reduce resolution requirements with respect to what would be required for full DNS, but I still need to take care of at least, you know, some partially resolving these features. I need some mesh points in that. If I have one point here, and, you know, thin layer in between, then obviously I will not do good job with any model unless I use parametrization. Yes, that I know exactly what is the structure of that and parametrization.
There's a region of high turbulent activity, and you have to resolve it.
Well, you have to resolve the region. You don't have to resolve all the details in the region.
But how much does he have? In other words,
he has to resolve everything that's inhomogeneous in some essential sense. Anything that is a homogeneous
I can tell you what I need to resolve for this to work. If you just look locally at turbulent region and you define local energy spectrum, I should resolve peak of the energy spectrum in that region. And the reason for that is very simple, because I generate my unresolved scales from nonlinear interactions among resolved ones. So if I don't resolve energy peak, if I'm, let's say, below the peak, there is no hope that I can generate energy peak from unresolved part. Yes, so I need to capture that, and in fact we did analysis of this by reducing resolution in the simulations as soon as cutoff hits the energy peak, then all results deteriorate very rapidly. If I'm to the right of the energy peak, then it's okay. So in all, you know, these cases that you mentioned, I should resolve the peak of the energy spectrum local.
Actually, with the shock, there's another difficulty, because the shock can amplify the energy at small scales.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you could have been resolving the energy peak before the shock hits it, but after the shock hits it, the energy peak may have shifted to the right.
Right.
That's a difficulty for all shock turbulence interactions. Is the initial condition for the vorticity ahead of the shock.
So I'm not alone.
No.
So now, to elaborate on the stratified problem a little bit further, if the stratified standard is the solar convection, then we have high stratification in the surface. So at first you may think maybe it's enough to have just enough mesh points in the vertical direction, and we don't need to have an equally thin meshing in the horizontal direction.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be true provided, as you now say, the horizontal scale does at least cover the peak of the,
yes,
of the spectrum. I think in the solar convection case, we don't even know that where the peak is, because it's probably beyond the scale of the granulation. It's probably larger,
mm-hmm,
than that. And so maybe there's not even a peak at anything where you think you shouldn't have to have the cutoff.
Yeah. The criterion that I have is essentially based on the observation in the, you know, when we were changing resolution for channel flow and for Rayleigh-Benard convection. That's as soon as you get close to the peak, then you cannot do it. And that's reasonable, because we have mechanisms where small scales are generated by large scales. So if they have to be energetic to produce something. If they are not, it doesn't work the other way around. You cannot get, in this case, energy peak from, non-energetic scales. Okay, thank you.